Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 43rd annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 14 through Sunday, July 16 at Cathedral Park in North Portland. Jazz, blues, soul, and Latin musicians will rock the park for 3 days. Curtis Delgado, Ural Thomas, Yak Attack, Chichito Valdez are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 43rd annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Portland's longest-running community event, July 14, 15, and 16, under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly houseless in our community and helping navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or are developing to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. Today, we have an exclusive interview with the manager of the county's new Behavioral Health Resource Center, Alexandra Appleton. Alexandra was born in North Portland, struggled with homelessness for a decade starting as a teenager, and managed to get into services, go to college, and is now helping other people out of homelessness and into stable, supportive housing.
I am very excited to be joined today by Alexandra Appleton. Alexandra was raised in North Portland, is a 2017 graduate of Portland State University, and has many accomplishments. She's worked with Oregon Justice Resource Center's Women in Prison Project, was a Home for Everyone coordinating board member, a Governor's Racial Justice Council member, a Call to Safety board member. She also worked at the Joint Office of Homeless Services and is now manager of the Behavioral Health Resource Center. She's a devoted mother and dedicated to becoming a good ancestor. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I just want to start by asking how you first got into the field of working in homeless services.
I entered the field actually through my experience in accessing Mercy Corps' Reentry Transition Center. It was a reentry program for individuals that had legal or criminal or civil histories. And barriers and supports included like navigation, transportation, clothing, mentorship, education, employment. And it just really helped folks that were released from incarceration get grounded and adjusted to society. So I started accessing that resource in 2013. I was recently released and I was homeless and I was also in treatment. And as someone who has experienced like homelessness and incarceration, like I understood the challenges that individuals had faced, but it really just started to ignite my passion to like start giving back in the right way, right? But with that being said, I enrolled in the Rentwell program because like I had an eviction on my record and I didn't have income. I just had housing barriers and I learned a lot. Like the Rentwell program taught me about my rights and responsibilities as a tenant. And then I used that information, long story short, you know, applied, advocated for myself, and then was able to obtain and sustain housing. And I was like, wow, this is so impressive. I'm learning this at like 32. It would have been great if I would have learned about this a long time ago. So I made it my mission to volunteer at the Reentry Center, instructing the Rentwell class for released individuals. And I learned about a lot because a lot of folks don't have a place to go when they are exited. And so that was my introduction two homeless services. In 2015, the director of the shelter that I stayed at had suggested that I apply for the coordinating board. And I was really nervous, but I did apply. And that changed my perspective and understanding of all of the complex factors contributing to homelessness and the need for comprehensive solutions. And then I also, when I graduated from PSU, I was fortunate to have that network of Home for Everyone. And I was able to get a job at one of the local nonprofits. And, you know, my job at Transition Project, you know, I got the support there from the leadership, and my career really took off from there. And I remained in homeless services in one way or the other.
Then what drew you to working with the Joint Office of Homeless Services?
I think the coordinating board, the Home for Everyone coordinating board. In my experience, you know, I was a person with lived experience. That was the position that I held on the coordinating board. And because I wasn't working, I was going to school at the time, I didn't have a conflict of interest. So I was able to like be involved in the equity committee or the resource allocation committee. You know, like I was able to have access to these high level decision-making opportunities that my peers that were going to school didn't have. You know what I'm saying? My peers with lived experience like me didn't have. Like, I was invited to the table and it just blew my mind. But the joint office staff really had to sit with me and onboard me to what it means to work in local government. It was a whole cultural shock, but they held my hand. So then, of course, there was a relationship of trust building, you know, and like there was trauma that was healed because I started to understand the macro, the micro, the picture. It was just a really interesting experience. And so I already had heart for the joint office because I knew the people were dedicated from day one. And then I had a lot of love for the people on the coordinating board because these were some high level people. I don't want to drop any names, but like these people like met with me for coffee and like walked me through it. It was funny because I was like, I have no idea what's going on. And they were like, we've been in this for 20 years and we don't have any idea what's going on. Don't worry about it. We're going to walk together, you know? So like that was, you know, I just fell in love with the joint office and the people and the mission from day one. And then when the opportunity came around COVID and they needed, they had an equity analyst position open, then I applied. And it was actually the best thing that happened to me. And with that, you know, I already, you know, kind of saw the passion that the staff had and the impacts that the scrutiny could have on them. So when I got to the joint office, I was really interested in workforce equity. I wanted to know how the staff were being taken care of. I really just wanted to make sure that they knew that they were valued, that they were appreciated, that, you know, they were seen, that we knew this work was difficult. But any way to help them sustain and be stable was like really my passion, because I had witnessed at all levels how difficult this work can be, especially in homeless services. So I was all about empowerment over there. We had a good time, but I worked on the equity team and I did a lot of other stuff over there too. And that's actually like my home site base. So I'm still able to go over there and run into all the family and joint office. I have a lot of love for them.
I wanted to ask if you can talk a little bit more about yourself, like your background and your experience with living unhoused and then the carceral system in the Portland area.
Well, yeah, I can talk about, like, you know, you mentioned that I was raised in North Portland. So I saw the intentional city disinvestment in the Black and brown community. I have lived experience with the Portland gentrification. It hurts real bad going back over to the old neighborhood. You know, being housed, it hurts. And being when I was unhoused, it hurt, you know? And so, you know, just seeing the city disinvestment over time was like my, I would say that was my first experience, like, you know, just living around the potential of being unhoused and housing instability and housing insecurity. But with that being said, in my personal life, when I was a teenager, I was coerced. It was a traumatic event, but I was coerced into the sex trade at the age of 16. And this led to a period of instability and insecurity in my life for a very long time. I didn't have a safe, stable, and secure place to stay. I was consistently on the go up and down the West Coast. My living situations involved temporary arrangements, you know, hotels, cars, couches between the ages of 18 and 27. I never really considered it as being homeless because I really never really slept on the streets. You know, I wasn't in a tent, but I didn't have any rental units in my name. I didn't have a place to call my own. But at that time, I really didn't think of it being homeless. It was life. It was a lifestyle. It was normal life. Everybody was doing it. But with that being said, at age 28, I experienced a turning point and I had my first child. And that became like a catalyst for positive change. I obtained legal employment and I was able to like secure housing. And I had a second child. But then around the time I was 32, you know, I was in an unhealthy relationship and that led to some unhealthy habits. And I found myself once again, like, homeless, incarcerated, more legal history, no employment, and charges, right? And so I had to make some executive decisions. You know, I had two babies. And so long story short is I was able to get into local treatment and then I was successfully able to graduate, but there was no exit plan because you couldn't get a job in the treatment that I was in. But then OHP, once you graduate, they're not going to continue to, you're keeping a bed. You got to go. I didn't have nowhere to go. So then I was like, had my babies in treatment, had nowhere to go, was a good member of society. What am I supposed to do? Thank gosh, I had a connection to a domestic violence shelter because I took some domestic violence training classes during my time of treatment and had created a relationship with a peer, you know, that looked like me. And I was able to find the resource and I got into a domestic violence shelter, which changed my life. And I was hesitant to go into the shelter because I have conceptions about what a shelter would be. I refused to go into a shelter, but then it was like the treatment was like, listen, this is your exit date. I went and it would change my life. I got into the Salvation Army's Women's West Domestic Violence Shelter for Women and Children. And that shelter specifically changed my life because of the way the program was run. And that's a whole different conversation, but I've kept those concepts and they've stayed with me. So everywhere I go, I embody those concepts and try to weave them into everything I do. I stayed at the shelter, was able to get employment, but I was also awarded a permanent supportive housing grant, which was game changing, right? So I got employed and then I got a permanent supportive housing grant. And that means that I could have had, I had housing for life unless I priced out. It was looking good. You know, I was doing good on paper. I was meeting all my court stipulations. I had a job. You know what I'm saying? I was in a shelter that was clean, that was safe, that was culturally responsive to me and my kids. I was repairing trauma. I was doing everything that I needed to do. And I got into an apartment and it was gravy. And then 2 weeks after I got into the apartment, the job that I had, because I was a certified nurse assistant, they pulled my license because of my legal history. And then I was jobless again. And then I was like, what am I going to do now? I mean, I love the permanent supportive housing, but like I'm a go-getter regardless. You know what I'm saying? So like I'm going to use that. I wanted to take advantage of that. Now that I didn't have to worry about paying for rent, then like what can I do with my time to improve my children, improve me, and be a better member to society? And so during the time that I had that permanent supportive housing grant, then I did what I needed to do. I couldn't get employed because my legal history, people were like, you need a break. We can't trust you for nothing. And so I started to have to volunteer everywhere. I started to have to get on boards anywhere that I could get transferable skills. And then I went back to school. I decided to go back to PSU. And at the time when I went back to PSU, I thought I was like borderline junior because even though I had like this track record of being on the streets and in the sex trade, I also attended school. I kind of justified it, right? I would be in school during the day, but then I'd be out in the streets at night. And so when I went back to PSU, I thought I was a borderline junior. So I was like, okay, cool. You know what I'm saying? I'm going back to school and I'm only going to have 1 year left. They told me I was a freshman because none of my credits transferred over because of the school and I changed my thing. So I was 32. And mind you, I started school 4 weeks after I had my third baby. So that's a whole different thing. So now I had three babies and I was going back to school. But long story short, what I did is I started off with one or two classes, worked myself up to five classes, went throughout the summer and graduated within 2 years and a half from PSU. Like I was on the grind. The permanent supportive housing grant allowed me to do that. Bottom line, the permanent supportive housing grant allowed me to go to school, take care of my kids, go do everything that my probation officer was telling me to do. volunteer, really be able to relax and still be able to like not worry about housing. And I successfully graduated from PSU, remained in my housing, didn't have no issues with my landlord. The Rentwell class helped me with that. I got a job at Transition Projects, worked there for a couple of years, transitioned to another local culturally specific nonprofit, and then I transferred to the joint office. I've moved housing since then to a bigger and better house because my family's grown. I just had another baby. I'm done. But the whole purpose is I eventually priced out. So this is the other part that I want to share. So I've maintained housing. I pay my rent on time. I know how to be a good tenant. You know, I've maintained it. I've worked really, really hard. What happened is as I moved up and got upward mobility, because I've really been on the grind since 2017, just thrusted up. I've obviously been economically, I have benefited from that. So that meant that I priced out of permanent supportive housing. So I priced out of permanent supportive housing back in like 2019. I had it 4 years and then I priced out. So I've been paying my rent by myself for the last almost 4 or 5 years completely. And even before that, I was still subsidized. What was interesting, and I want to share this, is now that I'm making a little bit of money, then I'm cut off from all the benefits from food stamps, childcare, any type of support in housing. And like, I'm barely making it with the 4 kids and the rent that's happening. Like, so I guess my point is that I wish they would like increase the cap for permanent supportive housing. And then I also wish that like there would be a little bit more consideration in regards to like increasing the annual income cap for social service benefits. That would really benefit like hardworking people like me. And then the last thing I want to share is that there are so many other women, and hopefully there needs to be more men, but other peers like me that have successfully graduated from permanent supportive housing. The idea is that people are going to get into permanent supportive housing and not do anything and just sit there. That is a myth. And I want to dispel that myth, because there are tons of people that actively work and do anything that they possibly can do and use that to their advantage to repair trauma and get their feet and get their grounding and then to sustain. And we'll do whatever they can to do that. Like, even though I'm housed right now, like I never really, what's missing from the system is everybody supported me into renting. They didn't really support me into home ownership. Considering that I'm like a biracial woman of a multicultural family, you know what I'm saying? I'm a little bit activated. I wish that the system would start introducing home ownership opportunities to people that have experienced homelessness that are on the right track sooner. Because like, if you think about it, I could have been, while I have permanent supportive housing, I could have been in a home ownership program. And then by the time I graduated, priced out of permanent supportive housing, I could have been a homeowner.
Thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to ask about your work in equity and inclusion. And I wonder if you could talk about like some of the disparities you've seen in homeless services and what you think is an effective way to address those historic and ongoing disparities.
I mean, that's a really complex question. My understanding is that disparities within homeless services are prevalent and they're deep-rooted. We see disproportionate representation of marginalized communities like people of color, LGBTQ, folks with behavioral health challenges among the unhoused population. It really highlights the need for equity and inclusion in our approaches. I feel like one of the ways that we can address disparities is by using trauma-informed and culturally responsive lenses. It also is recognizing and addressing like systemic barriers that contribute to the disparities. I see that like we're amplifying voices of marginalized communities and actively involving them in decision-making processes. It also involves building like strong partnerships with community organizations and leaders who have an understanding of the specific needs of the different populations. One of the key disparities that I've seen is the disproportionate representation of marginalized communities, specifically BIPOC individuals, among the homeless population living on the streets. Like, so they're not accessing any of the resources, not able to access the shelters, not able to access treatment, healthcare, anything. Like, they're on the streets, you know, and this reflects systemic racism. There has to be efforts to address specific challenges faced by our communities, our BIPOC communities that are living on the streets. Another disparity is a lack of accessible and culturally responsive services. You know, it's one thing to do a referral, but you know how hard it is to get into the service. You can refer all day, but each service is at capacity. There's a waiting list. There's some type of intake. There's hoops to go through. It's not just like you can just send folks to get whatever they need. And then there's a lack of services. I feel like folks with diverse backgrounds, they struggle to access the appropriate resources in general. And without like the more appropriate and responsive resources, it just becomes even more challenging. I think local government and leadership can continue to center voices with lived experience in homelessness and behavioral health. You know, most important is to listen and collaborate with stakeholders, service providers who've been working in the field. And then I think there could be a lot more effort in community education campaigns. We need to raise that awareness and challenge the misconceptions about homelessness and foster empathy and understanding and support for the broader community. When folks have information, then they're able to make better decisions in dispelling stereotypes, providing accurate information and encouraging community engagement, and in finding solutions together is the direction that I see that we're heading. And I feel very honored that I've been involved in some of the processes. And then like, as far as equity and inclusion goes, you know, like I'm really passionate about giving somebody what they need. I think everybody's unique and everybody should have a voice in regards to what they need. And I don't feel like folks should put on their white cape and come save the day, because that's unrealistic and it's unfair. It's unfair to the person that puts on the white cape, because what if they fail? And it's unfair to the person that you're trying to help, because it doesn't build trust. Give people what they want, and inviting more voices to the table will make a better outcome. So I kind of live by that motto.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you bring that up, that kind of saviorism, like put on your cape and help. I see what you're doing at the Behavioral Health Resource Center as kind of the opposite of that. You're a peer-led model, and it's everybody working together, your peers who have been through it. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, what sets the Behavioral Health Resource Center apart is its peer-led approach, which emphasizes like the involvement of individuals with lived experience and expertise in behavioral health and or homelessness, folks that are accessing our services. The approach recognizes the power of shared experience, the support that individuals can provide to one another on their paths to recovery and stability. And so at the BHRC, individuals with lived experience of homelessness and behavioral health challenges play a central role in guiding and supporting those in crisis and our folks that are accessing our services. The peer support specialists have firsthand knowledge of the struggles and obstacles or barriers faced, and they offer a unique perspective and understanding and empathy that can truly make a difference in someone's lives. You know, like it wasn't until I saw a peer that looked like me and that had shared the same experience, that was doing better than me, that then I wanted that. You know, that's the power of peer mentorship.
Like, how do you build trust with someone having a crisis? And I wonder what's your approach at the BHRC to that type of situation?
Well, our approach is to meet the person where they're at. You know, we can't assume what's going on, you know, validate the experience. You know, in a lot of experience, a person just needs to be validated. Now, if you just validate what their experience is and allow them just to be, then they can be. So I think that is the very first approach that we take, is as long as everybody's safe and nobody's getting hurt, then we allow it to be, because it's temporary and fixable. It's better for us to assess the situation. But if somebody's just having an episode, it is okay to have a temper tantrum. It may be an inconvenience to me because it's in a public place, but you just recognize that this person is having a moment, and everybody that's human has the right to have a moment. So that's my approach. Now, once it becomes like a safety concern, then there's other strategies that could be taken. Building trust with individuals experiencing mental health crisis is essential, and it takes time. Number one, they deserve it. And number two, trust is necessary to provide effective support and help them identify the accesses and resources they need. So our team understands the importance of like creating a safer and non-judgmental environment. You know, our motto is that we create a safer space, because it's impossible to create a safe space. We can't dictate safety for somebody else. They get to dictate their safety, and then we get to ask them, and then they can tell us, and then we can tell them how we can help them and accommodate it. We actively listen to individuals, again, validate experience, and then demonstrate empathy and compassion.
I know we're out of time, but I just wanted to kind of bring this together that, like, we are in a society where there's this requirement that you have a kind of mind-body disconnect to be successful. How do you define mental health, well-being in a society that really doesn't value that?
Well, I think well-being encompasses more than just like the physical health. I mean, it encompasses like the holistic state of the person. And that includes like mental, emotional, and social well-being. You know, it's all really interconnected, and it's about having the resources and support necessary to have a fulfilling and meaningful life. I believe everybody has mental health, and I feel like we should approach the conversation differently. Like, we talk about like mental health as like a negative thing, like, oh, that person has mental health. Like, everybody has mental health. Now, where you're at on that spectrum may be different, but instead of saying like that person's having that mental health challenge, we should, you know, just normalize it a little bit more. Like, mental health, you know, it is what it is. You know, we have to challenge some notions in society that tell us that we're defined by material wealth and status. I really do feel like mental health is really, really important. And the sooner that we normalize mental health and start really caring for folks' needs as they define, then I feel like we're going to develop a more inclusive society. It also offers us an opportunity to really look at the policies and practices and prioritize like equity and dismantling like systemic barriers and ensuring that folks have access to quality education, affordable healthcare, stable housing. If those things are happening, then people's mental health is going to improve as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing your story and all of this insight with us. Thanks, Alexandra.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Security income and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. Please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. You can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by searching for Out of the Streets of Portland. And you can find this podcast, along with a ton of information, data, and reports, at our website, multco.us/JOHS. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland. La 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 la
I'm Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey. Help us shape the types of news, public affairs, and music programming KBOO broadcasts in the future. Tell us how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous. However, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. Complete the community survey before Sunday, July 16th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. That's kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.